Howdy, Lock you all. Howdy, you all. Welcome to Trend by the Turmoil. And I am everyone's favorite drunken hillbilly, J.D. Moonshine. And as always, along with me, that crazy old man, QT. And we also have that prick, Sign Guy. Well, we also have a special treat for you all today, because we are joined by our guest, Pro Wrestling Torch's very own Bruce Mitchell. How you doing today, Bruce?
Doing fine. Just nice day, sunshine, and kind of some cool air, and yeah, doing all right.
That's good. That's good. Staying safe. Staying healthy. Okay,
yep.
Let's see. I do have a few questions for you. Let's see what I have here.
Cool.
Okay, well, I want to start it off a little simple, a little easy. We'll start it off right. How long have you been writing about wrestling or, writing period or, doing articles?
I really started around the time that I've been writing letters back in the day when this was a big thing to do to the Wrestling Observer. It was long, before the internet. And then I met Wade Keller at the Great American Bash. What was it, 1990, when Sting beat Flair, and he asked me to start writing. So I started then. It's been coming up in September. I think it'll be 30 years.
So, 30 years.
Yeah, so I've been doing it for a good long time. I mean, through a lot of different iterations of the internet and technology. I've done radio shows and 900 lines and blogs and message boards and podcasts. I have the longest running weekly podcast of anybody, and all kinds of stuff. So yeah, and all kinds of wrestling stories.
It seems that you've been definitely doing this for a while.
Yeah, I have been.
what really brought you in, besides, them asking you to write or whatever, what really brought you into the business? Like, what made you really want to be a writer or really want to, do what you do?
For the first years of being a wrestling fan, I was just really hungry for, places to find some good, information on the wrestling business. And I read the magazines, and I just got really fascinated with it. And then started subscribing to the Wrestling Observer and found the Torch and newsletters and that kind of thing. But I always wanted to be or saw myself as a writer. I was a big reader. And I never thought about being a wrestler or anything. That wasn't it. But and so I just started writing about that, and then just the practice of writing every week and every month. And I wrote longer form articles than most people did, and because I'm pretty good with big picture stuff, and so connecting everything, that was something I would try to do whatever it was I was writing about. And wrestling's such a great thing to write about in that you've got everything. You've got athletics, you've got politics, you've got drugs, you've got you've got cultural things, you've got con men, you've got all kinds of you've got all kinds of volatile subjects in it. And some of it's funny and some of it's tragic and some of it is boring, and it's just, it's got everything. So, I've definitely dealt with people really liking what I've written, and I've dealt with people wanting to beat my ass for what I've written, and, and legal issues and all kinds of stuff. So it's a really cool, as far as like being a writer, it's the kind of writing I wanted to do, the kind of writing that people respond to. And, there's always something new. The business is always evolving and changing, and it's it comes out of the carnivals and the origins of kind of a con man business, and still is, and that makes for something really fun to write about and really sometimes really important to write about. So, you know, life and death and everything in between.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, wrestling's always, you know, there's always something different, always something new. You never know what you're going to get.
See, I mean, yeah, I never would have thought that we'd have an era of an empty arena wrestling. I'm just like that. I mean, of course, the whole world is, you know, really changed, and we're off into this place none of us thought we'd ever be. But it's, yeah, I mean, there's always keeping up with it and learning more about it too. I always like reading about the past of it and learning more and all that. So I take wrestling and wrestling writing as, you know, just what comes and how it does. And I've had some great experiences. So it's really been some fun to do.
Yes, it has. Okay. Let's see. I have another question. Let's go with since you've been doing this for like 30 years, you've probably written a lot of articles. But do you remember what like your very first one that actually got written or published?
You know, I remember my first one. The one though, this came up. You know, with Joe Pedicino passing away, the first one I wrote that got some attention and people who were both liked it and were upset by it was about the late Eddie Gilbert, that Eddie Gilbert had been working in WCW and basically had gone to another publication where he's friends with the editor, Steve Beverly and Matt Watch, and laid out this whole thing about how things were bad for him in WCW and how they weren't treating him right, and he was going to retire from professional wrestling. He was a young guy. He was going to retire and all this and move into politics and move into these other arenas. And so he got out of his contract in WCW and, I don't know, 10 days later turned up booking in Memphis, booking Jerry Lawler and the Memphis territory. And so I kind of, you know, I just wrote something that said this wasn't very honest. And Eddie was kind of a friend, one of the first wrestlers who saw putting a story out in newsletters was something that could help him politically, but I thought he didn't do a very good job with it. And so that article, and then Joe Pedicino and the Global Wrestling Federation, and being financed by a Nigerian who had come up with $25 million. Based on him answering one of those, you know, one of the what became the famous emails that we all get, but actually been like a con man artist but one of the con man things that had been done for 100 years was called the Spanish Princess Letter, where a princess would send a letter to someone who is a leader in a small town, maybe a bank manager or something, and say that she had all this money in an account, that she was needed some help, and send her $1,000, and she'd come back with $500,000, and the same thing we see today. And he had come out with he was going to use $25 million to start basically a new NWA, a new. You know, with all these different territories in different parts of the country and all this stuff. And I kind of wrote something about it a couple of weeks after he had talked to the Torch and saying that no, he wasn't. And that this was kind of a bunch of BS and pointing out the $25 million. And that really, I try to, like, write what I would want to read, which is I would want the stuff as true as I could get it. And as inside as I could get it. And so what I was reading, so that's what I try to write. And so I try to get it right. You know, I try to have details behind it and all that. But sometimes it's going to piss off people. And sometimes sometimes these people need to be pissed off. And so that was one of the times. And so that was kind of the start for me of taking an issue and really going into it deep and and whether it was good or bad, telling all the truth about it.
And letting people know, I totally understand that, you know, I mean, people got to know the truth sometimes, and truth hurts.
And also, you know, if the truth comes out, then things will change. I mean, sometimes it's incrementally, but, you know, there's more drug testing. There's more health things in professional wrestling, I believe, than there would have been if there hadn't have been, you know, a place for the mainstream media and for people to go and that was knowledgeable and independent of professional wrestling, wasn't trying to get a job, wasn't trying to, you know, curry favor necessarily, just try to get the story right. And I think that helps too. I think that things that are, you know, things that sometimes are wrong stay wrong because there's no exposure, there's no light shined on it. And I think that's a problem even today for professional wrestling. But hopefully, you know, I've seen some good get done over the years, and I've seen some stuff that should have gotten done and didn't get done. But you know, you can be disappointed and all like that. It's also like, you know, see this new guy who's really good, and watch this person or hear something that really is catching on. It's worth seeing, or here's why this is doing good business and over here isn't. You know, like all that kind of stuff counts too.
Yeah, totally. Okay, I have a question. Since you've been on the scene for some time and seen probably just about everything, what do you think, in your own opinion, what do you think is like the best promotion today? I mean, you think that has like the story,
it depends on how you frame what best is, but I'm always, as far as I see wrestling in two ways. One of them is just what I like, my favorites. And I can, you know, I think sometimes people go, this such and such is the greatest of all time. And, you know, this tag team wrestler was the greatest tag team wrestler of all time and all that kind of stuff. And what they're really saying is, this is my favorite. Like, I saw a lot of wrestlers, and this is my favorite. And I have my favorites, and I have my things that I like. I'm a big promo guy. I like guys that can cut good promo, you know, good promos that make you want to go see a fight and all that. I think that's where the money is. But I'm also like, when you're writing about wrestling and when you're following wrestling, you follow the money. In other words, the stuff that's good is the stuff that's producing revenue. For whatever the revenue streams are, it's the stuff that people are paying attention to. And, you know, and so in the time I've been watching wrestling, I can remember watching in World Class and in Dallas and a little bit in Memphis, and then watching him come into WCW, and that was Stunning Steve Austin. And Stunning Steve Austin thinking, oh, my God, this guy is really dead on in his wrestling work. And his promos are pretty good, but they're not pushing him the way they should be. You know, watch that and be frustrated with it, and then seeing him get that opportunity to be even more like himself as Stone Cold Steve Austin and, you know, be that people's hero. And then also watching Vince McMahon all those years get ready to play the role that, you know, he was just meant to play. And he got overexposed to that after a while, but it was like, you know, Mr. McMahon, he was like a great heel. And he had it inside him, and he had to, like, hold it back and, you know, it'd be the play-by-play guy, you know, be the voice of the people, play-by-play guy. And then when he finally got a chance to tap into his own villainy, I mean, it was really something, you know, something great to see. So, yeah, there's been a lot. I mean, I always point to the promotion that I, you know, you asked me what's the best now. You know, WWE is really good in certain ways, and they built something, but they have so many creative problems that even before this that they've really kind of suffered from, and suffered from not from either, you know, not telling the stories about, not finishing telling their stories, and just, you know, you sit there and go, oh, this is driving me crazy because it doesn't make that much sense. So right now I would say that, you know, there's been some New Japan Pro Wrestling is really consistent And you know, until they went on their hiatus, really was consistent for the last several years of building up, playing the long game, and building up champions and building up contenders of those championships, and doing a great job in main events. And I've never seen anything as athletic as the wrestling we have today. I mean, it's just like it's not just doing big things athletically, but doing the little things too. So in the ring, that's really been great. And to see the Bucks and Cody and that situation with AEW build from two or three promotions and do it in a kind of grassroots way without the help of WWE, without the help of the major league, it's a pretty amazing thing. And then this promotion just went out of business after 20 years, just locally in this area, but I got a chance to see, and he's Cameron Grimes on NXT, but Trevor Lee wrestling locally here was as good a wrestler as I've ever seen, and was as good a wrestler as anybody in the world wrestling 20 minutes away from me in his studio, in the CWF Mid-Atlantic wrestling studio. And he's kind of moving into NXT too, but it's I go by Ric Flair. I mean, Ric Flair is why I'm a wrestling fan. And when I was in high school, I was told to watch Ric Flair, and I did. And you can argue. I'm much more about who's the best of their time in their own era. But the best I've ever seen, like consistently year after year, against an enormous amount of different people, and building them up to be better than they were, was Flair. So, and then the promos added to it too. But the best right now is New Japan Pro Wrestling, as far as drawing money but also being really good in the ring. WWE has got a lot of advantages they've built up over the years, but they've been very disappointing as far as their content, for the last several years. So I can't point to them and say they're the best. So and then AEW establishing, establishing itself to the point that they got a cable television contract for legitimate money. No one besides WWE has ever done that, and they did it within a year. So I watched them as like they're catching on with their fan base, and for the most part they're doing straight up good shows, and a lot of things they use a lot of things from the past that WWE doesn't use, and they tell a better long term story. So that would be where I'd say, but right now still there's a lot of room for wrestling to grow, and we'll see what happens after this empty arena thing goes by.
Yeah. Okay.
I answered about seven questions in that one. Sorry about that.
That's right. I only have one more question for you. And everybody's saw on Twitter how you and Dave Meltzer blasted Vince Russo. So my question is, what do you really think about Vince Russo's booking?
Yeah, he was terrible. I mean, it's like there's no, he helped. I mean, I've been following the guy since he got in professional wrestling. And when he did 180-degree turn in his newsletter and in his radio show in New York that he was doing with John Arezzi to curry favor with the WWE, and they paid him back by because they didn't want that radio show to be on in New York, and they paid him back by giving him a job and with their magazine, with WWE magazine, and he basically took the Paul Heyman ECW approach that Vince McMahon wasn't keeping up with, and brought it to WWE, and you can talk about him contributing to WWE during the time that they had Steve Austin, Stone Cold Steve Austin, and The Rock, and all that. But McMahon was McMahon is always the booker, but he did help him with that. But then after that, between the time he worked in WCW, a couple of years he was in WCW, and the years that he worked in TNA and got and got renewed time after time after time, he's cost the wrestling business millions of dollars by his booking not being very good. And even to this day, he'll defend himself and go, "What about the ratings?" and try to compare the ratings world from 20 years ago to the ratings world for today. And his ratings that he did, in context of what was going on at the time, they weren't that great. But the job wasn't to draw ratings. The job was to draw pay-per-views. It was to get the people that were watching your television show to order. That's where the revenue came from, to order the pay-per-views. And he was terrible at that. And WCW, he was one of the major reasons why they went out of business. I mean, he came and accelerated their downfall. And then TNA, the Carter family paid him over and over again, and he never produced. And they lost millions of dollars. And then the kind of content that he produced, it was about TNA, but it was also about women suck and women are whores and sluts and shooting the camera angles right up into their costumes and all this kind of stuff. And he did a lot of bad booking, and it never really, he never told stories that made very much sense. They would start off, and then if you're trying to get something in every single quarter hour, that's going to shock people, what you end up with is not shocking anybody, because that's just not sustainable. You can't have a shock every. So anyway, Vince Russo is one of those people that I just look at and go, didn't do a good job, was very lucky to get paid all those years, and now turned that brand into woe is me, I'm a victim. And I don't think he is a victim. I think he's not a very good person, and he's not a very good he didn't learn very much from what he was doing, and then just wasn't trustworthy behind the scenes at all, even in a cutthroat kind of untrustworthy business like professional wrestling. But I don't do as much about him in content on for the Torch, because he's been out of the business and it doesn't come up that much. But on Twitter, it's come up, and I'm not playing with him. It's like he didn't do a good job, and he can get people to feel sorry for him. But most of the people that do didn't follow the business at the time where he was out there failing, or they didn't watch his shows. I watched his shows. I read his books. I saw his DVDs. I watched his I watched his DVD for Ring of Glory, for the church that he started, the wrestling project he started, and he's full of it, and he's full of it in a way that he fools himself, but it isn't fooling me. So, for that matter, much of anybody else in professional wrestling, since he's pretty much unemployable these days.
I completely agree with you. I mean, I've never really liked the guy too much, and I've seen a lot of the stuff that he's done, and I never really understood a lot of what he tried to do. So I completely understand that. But because of you, Bruce, thank you. I've learned a lot. I'm pretty sure our listeners have learned a lot from you. But I'm out of questions, so I guess I'm going to pass it over to that guy, Sign Guy.
Doing well, Bruce. How are you?
Doing just fine.
Well, Bruce, one of the things about pro wrestling for the people that are performers, most of us enjoy traveling, and that's part of the allure of it. We get to travel all over in order to ply our craft. There's a lot of travel if you're on the side of the business that JB and myself are on as performers. But for someone like you that writes for the newsletters and runs websites, it may not be as travel intensive, but what would you say has been the farthest trip that you've taken for pro wrestling?
I went to the LA Sports Arena to see AAA. I've been to Tijuana to see professional wrestling. I've been to Hazard. No, Pikeville, Kentucky. I've been to the Nassau Coliseum in New York. I've been to the ECW Arena in Philadelphia more than once. I went to Knoxville, Tennessee. I've been to Charlotte, North Carolina. I've been to the Greensboro Coliseum. In fact, I could throw a rock from where I'm sitting here on my bed right now and hit the Greensboro Coliseum because I live right down the street from it. I've been to the Dorton Arena. I used to go pretty regularly to the Dorton Arena to watch wrestling. I went to Tennessee. What was it? The Scenic City Invitational. So whatever the Scenic City was for that weekend tournament. I went to Chicago for AEW pay-per-view. For All In, and then I went to Baltimore for WCW and for the live cast and the live cast in Chicago too, and for AEW. So I mean, I've done some traveling. Is it the type of traveling that you do when you work full time for a wrestling company that's running shows, 52 weeks a year? No. I also was a school teacher during all that time. I've never been to WrestleMania, for example. But and I haven't been to Japan yet, and I've been close, but it just hasn't worked out for me for that. So I've seen some stuff. I'll put it like that.
Definitely sounds like that's a pretty good list of towns for someone. Now, as a newsletter writer, I'm sure over the years you've written things that certain people did not agree with, or they had a different opinion than you had. I'm sure you've gotten some angry phone calls and letters over the years. What would you say has been the most heat you've had over something you've written?
Lately I get some heat when I think WWE has and wrestling has this from time to time. I've written about it many times over the years. But when there's been something that's happened that's been like a Kofi Kingston's push, where there's been some unpleasant racial overtones to stories that they told on television, so had those, and that's come up. WCW, and this was in Dark Side of the Ring, but the New Jack episode of Dark Side of the Ring brought back a lot of this, but New Jack attacking Eric Koolis in Revere, Massachusetts. I was the first one to really write about that and to write about it in depth. And I would say that until you've seen the footage of that, what happened for 20 straight minutes of that kid getting, getting beaten down and them having a hard time stopping the flow of blood coming out of the top of his head and all the rest of it. You don't get the horror of what that was, but and all that. So there was a lot of anger at me for writing about it, and then there was a story to try to scapegoat me about it, where it was a completely false story that I'd sent a tape to the pay-per-view people. They were about to go on pay-per-view when this thing happened, and it almost got canceled, and it got postponed for several months. And so instead of being angry at the managers who were at the show at that night, Paul Heyman and whoever else was there, or New Jack for what had happened, it was more, oh no, it was Mitchell. And it was like, no, you guys did this. And you sold the tape. I got the tape only because you were sitting there selling it and trying to like make money off of it until you realized what a foolish thing was. But I'm fine. And there was a lot of heat with that. Though I got wrestlers and people wanting to beat my ass and all that kind of stuff. But it's like, I'm fine with that. If what I write, I can believe it myself And I know that I have to have 100% of the details and get them in the right place and get it right and make my case really strongly, then I'm fine with the heat, particularly if it's something that's a matter of right and wrong. So, and I think that doing that in the long term does good for the business because it stops them from doing things that's going to damage them and or slows them down or holds them accountable for it, however you want to say. So, I've had several of those things over the years that have gone on. I've also had people that I really very much respect in professional wrestling and let me know that they appreciated what I did or that they liked something specifically that I'd written or they had respect for it. So I'm fine with that side too. I'm not looking to be an evangelist for professional wrestling. I'm not looking to tear it down either. I'm just looking to write about it truthfully and get it right.
Now, you mentioned to JB a little while ago that Eddie Gilbert kind of had a hand in getting you started in wrestling, and it was the Eddie Gilbert angle in the UWF that kind of hooked me on wrestling, where he and his father were in the UWF, and Tommy Gilbert was senior referee and resigned because his son was breaking all of the rules and putting him in an awkward position. I always said, and I'm honestly biased on this because I love the Gilbert family, but I always considered him the most underrated family in wrestling as a whole. Tommy, Doug, and Eddie, all brilliant bookers, all brilliant performers. What do you think about the Gilberts as an overall family in wrestling? Do you think that they're maybe underrated? Do you think they're revered the right amount, overrated? How are you feeling on that?
Well, I think first you start with Tommy. And I think Tommy was, a guy who was really versatile, that he could main event or he could work in the middle of a card or he could give you the opening match or he could be the referee or, and it depended on what, where he was in his career, how old he was. But really, was a mainstay in Memphis, but could go to Kansas City, did some work in the Carolinas, could talk and could work and, just a solid all the way. When I look at Eddie Gilbert, I look at, I think a guy who in some ways booking was ahead of his time, but I also think, a tragedy in that he tried, and there's other wrestlers that are like this too. He wanted so much to be the king of Memphis, to follow Jerry Lawler and to follow his father in Memphis, and to be that next, be that next king of Memphis. Except there wasn't going to be another king of Memphis because the wrestling business changed so much. And then where his father could work in the territorial era and working promotions that respected smaller men and smaller wrestlers, Eddie had a harder time with that. And Eddie working in, I saw him working as the rookie babyface in WWF, and I saw him, in the different places. And he had, so he was small in a time where steroids were a big thing, and having a lot of muscle mass was a big thing. And then he had the car wreck, and when he was working up in New York and for the WWF and broke his neck. And between that and recovering from that and adding muscle mass with steroids and just, and then recreational drug habits and all that, you can watch him over the course of his career, and he was really good. He was a really good communicator, and he learned from Bill Watts and worked with him and learned in Memphis from Jerry Jarrett and Jerry Lawler and started in a lot of ways Eastern Championship Wrestling with Todd Gordon and was the guy who was teaching Paul Heyman, but he was also having so many problems being reliable because of his drug problems that Paul Heyman took over for him and kind of pushed him to the side in ECW. But I I was there in Smoky Mountain when he made his debut on television, and I knew how conflicted Jim Cornette was about using him because he burned so many bridges between that WCW and all these places that he had worked and quit and not shown up and all that kind of thing. I think he's a tragic case. I mean, I think that he had a lot more to do in professional wrestling, but between the traveling and the pressure to be bigger and the pressure to perform and the pressure to take the bumps and do the politics and to keep straight, he had a hard time with it. If you watch him over his career, he got more, damaged. And so, dying of a heart attack at that very young age. I think the Gilberts, and then Doug, following Eddie, was able to get jobs with Eddie, but also had his problems and then never was able to go national. And also the business, the wrestling business changed in the way I was talking about, where the guys that could talk but weren't big had a tougher time. There weren't as many places to work. And so, Doug worked a little bit for WCW and then worked, did some job work in the WWE and worked Memphis. But the business changed from out from under him too. So, but yeah, there's a lot of wrestling families and the Gilberts touched a lot of different places and did good work for, at the end of the day, I think like they were all three like good wrestlers. And not just in the ring, but promo ability and ability to think of what would connect with fans. I mean, they did a good job.
I definitely agree with you there. One of the things I wanted to ask you about was something that we learned this week. A former guest of this very show, Chris Cruz, had filed a complaint with the Maryland State Athletic Commission about a match AEW presented late last year. The Athletic Commission came back with their decision this week. They fined AEW $10,000, but more importantly, if AEW were to go back to Maryland and get another complaint, then their promotional license in that state would be at risk, which would affect business as a whole for AEW. What can you tell us about what you know and about what you think over this situation with Chris Cruz, the Athletic Commission, and AEW?
Yeah, a couple of things. One of them is, Athletic Commissions, there are states in the union that don't have them, and they're kind of a pastime, from the old days, and it was more the boxing commissions running boxing shows, and then wrestling commissions. They would, Portland and Oregon had a wrestling commission that really interfered a lot with the wrestling promotions. But there's a need for regulation in professional wrestling to have, for example, to have things that are common sense, like doctors at wrestling shows, just in case someone gets hurt. And that, there's some things that could be done that aren't done. And then there's some of these, a lot of the places, the athletic commissions were there to provide some cronies with some jobs during a wrestling show. If you're friends of the athletic commission, you could make some money working a wrestling show and then take bribes. I mean, that was the history of it, and not really do a whole lot as far as that goes. And as far as like making sure that the right amount of people, that there weren't too many people over capacity in a show or something like that. So anyway, all of that, those are real issues that probably should have been taken care of and haven't been for years. And then Baltimore and then Maryland was notorious for having a stricter athletic commission, particularly about the issue of blood, to the fact that like in 1988, Ric Flair and Lex Luger had a match in the Great American Bash where they played off in Baltimore, where Luger was the young upcoming guy who was going to beat Flair for the NWA title, and his big hold was the torture rack, and so he jacked up Flair into the torture rack, but Luger had cut his forehead just a little bit, and a little bit of blood was coming out, so they had the athletic commission guy run in and say, and stop the match, and fans had thought that he'd beaten Flair and won the NWA title, but no, there was a little bit of blood on Luger, and so the match was stopped, and Flair kept the title, and that led to rematches across the country that made that, you know, WCW, Jim Crockett Promotions, desperate for good attendance, and they got good attendance out of the rematches of that. So it was a place that was, you know, famous for, you know, for not having much tolerance for blood. I mean, the wrestling promotion at that time used it as part of their finish, but it was censored. As it happened, I was at that show, and I was at the show in for AEW where they got fined, and it was, you know, a hardcore match between Kenny Omega and John Moxley, and I, you know, a lot of fans liked the match. I hated the match. It went on too long, and it was too much violent BS. It didn't make any sense, and it was too much, just too much. Let's bring in this barbed wire and that bat and that this and that, and smack the guy in the head and all this stuff. The blood was there, and so, and I'm not surprised that, you know, it happened in Maryland. And I know that before Cruz sent his letter in to them or contacted them, that they were looking at it. It was kind of a foolish thing to do. I think as far as like what the law or the regulation was from the Maryland Athletic State Commission was like pretty clear, and they clearly broke it. And they got the fine that you would get, which was $10,000. My problem with Chris Cruz, and I've known Chris for years and was friends with him for many years, and he lived around here. But he kind of changed, and he was very much on social media, and he is to this day kind of acting what he thinks a heel acts like. And he cut off his friends here, around here, and stopped talking to people he'd been talking to for years and years, and stopped being friends with people he had been just out of nowhere. And so that was kind of weird. And I've always said that Chris was 80% of a pretty, you know, a really intelligent person, and 20% of a nut. And so the 20% kind of coming out, and, you know, and he works for Voice of America in the media. You know, he's a reporter for Voice of America. So he really didn't see the match. He just read the account of it in the Wrestling Observer by Dave Meltzer, and then used his contacts to go directly to the Maryland State Athletic Commission. If he's offended by it, that's fine. But I also think, you know, writing this stuff where at the same time he's calling people in AEW and fans marks and trying to play heel and trying to, you know, be this villain is unprofessional. It's like it's a bunch of crap and he shouldn't be doing that. It's like, you know, so that's where I've known Chris for a long time, and I've had the discussion with him, like, you're not being a heel when you do that. That's not, you know, I've seen him do things when he worked on wrestling shows, and I said, that's not, you know, you're just doing cheap heat stuff, and it's not all that great. But he's an interesting guy now, and I think that AEW, if they go back to Baltimore, won't break those regulations, and they'll be fine. But yeah, I mean, I happen to be at that show, and then like I said, I've known Chris I know a lot about Chris Cruz, so I'm not surprised at that point. He was a good ring announcer. I mean, and particularly with Terry Funk back in the day, and then he's also he's an interesting, strange guy sometimes, and this is one of them.
Well, at this point, our co-host QT Vokes is standing by. I know QT has a couple of questions, so QT, go ahead.
Well, thank you, JB, and thank you, Sun Guy. Hello, Bruce.
What's going on, man?
Not too much. Bruce, Henry Rollins was lead singer of the rock group Black Flag from early 1981 to mid-1986. Since Black Flag, he went on to form the Henry Rollins Band, as well as doing tours of his spoken words. He has also published many books, including Get in the Van, a book about his touring days with Black Flag. He also hosts a weekly radio show on the station KCRW, and he is a regular columnist for Rolling Stones Australia and a regular columnist for LA Weekly. He even appeared a few times in the TV show Sons of Anarchy and Jackass. Have you ever met Henry Rollins, or are you aware of some of his songs with Black Flag, like TV Party, Rise Above, and My War?
Yeah, I've never met Henry Rollins, but I know who he is, and I know some of his music. And then he's a good writer. It's like he's a good straight-up writer and, you know, volatile raconteur. I mean, he's good at what he does and has, you know, it's changed up over the years. But, Henry Rollins is a badass. Yeah, I know about this.
Yeah, he keeps himself in pretty good shape. I myself think that he would do fairly well in the wrestling ring. Do you agree?
Well, he's got some star personality, some star power, and, aggressive alpha male and all that kind of stuff could probably cut promos as far as that goes, can present himself, you know, really well. As far as, like, does he have any athletic ability, or could he, perform a wrestling match? He's too old now, but I don't know. But as far as, like, the personality, there's some pro wrestling in what he does. There's some hype in what he does, no doubt.
Oh, okay. Well, I know that he used to be all over the stage during, and he was in good shape with Black Flag.
Black Flag could go, no doubt. Yeah, and that was, you know, real powerful driving stuff. So, yeah, he had to have some cardio to do it. And as you said, you know, part of his image is always the, you know, the guy in the T-shirt that's muscled up. So, yeah, maybe so. I'm not saying no, I'm not saying yes, but I am very much a believer that to be a good professional wrestler takes a lot of training, takes a lot of sacrifice and all that. And so, Until you really do it, you haven't proven a whole lot. So, but yeah, as far as like his personality, and as far as if things have been different for him, and he chosen to go that way, maybe he could have.
Okay, all right. Well, Bruce, at the opposite end of the spectrum, about 30 years ago, the gonzo journalist Hunter S. Thompson, the author of the seminal book Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, was still alive. Was Hunter S. Thompson an influence on you?
Huge influence on me. I love Hunter S. Thompson. I love Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. I love Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail. I have, I think, pretty much every one of his books. I've never found exactly what he's talking about, but he claims in Great Shark Hunt that he wrote wrestling columns in Florida for one of the wrestling promoters. And so I was like, oh man. But yeah, as far as the tell the truth and to tell it in an entertaining way and tell it all straight. I'm also influenced by him in the sense of I'm not a drug person. And as much as I loved his stuff, I kind of realized that to have that sharp edge, for me at least, it was better to stay out of that and to watch him and to watch his gifts. He really was what he said he was, you know, Raoul Duke and all that, you know, early on. And then he had a hard time with deadlines. He had a hard time, you know, producing stuff. And sometimes it would be brilliant and sometimes it would be not so good. And I learned from that too. But yeah, Dr. Thompson, yeah, right up there. I'm a guy who reads a lot, and a lot of my favorite writing. I love, you know, I think that approach is, you know, particularly politically, is like needed all the time. I shudder to think what he would have thought after his death of how poorly politics went. But you know, but to look at something and to tell it all true, you know, Hunter Thompson was the man.
Okay. All right. Very good. Very good. I have a quote from him entitled "Extreme Behavior in Aspen," February 3rd, 2003. And he says, "We are turning into a nation of whimpering slaves to fear. Fear of war, fear of poverty, fear of random terrorism, fear of getting downsized or fired because of the plunging economy, fear of getting evicted for bad debts, or suddenly getting locked up in a military detention camp on vague charges of being a terrorist sympathizer. Question is, why wasn't there ever a wrestler called the terrorist sympathizer?"
Yeah, I mean, it was a terrorist or whatever. It's a little too generic, is what I would say. Like, it's a little too, what does that mean? And, you know, I think that sometimes that you'll get a villainous name and try to fit a guy to it, and there's not a whole lot depth to it. That's just my reaction to that. I think that, you know, I think that, in Fear and Loathing Las Vegas, I think his lawyer might have made a good wrestler. And, you know, I definitely know that Jim Mitchell was, Father James Mitchell was influenced by Dr. Thompson and his character. And, you know, there's definitely some, you know, Samoans that were, you know, that he would write about and that kind of thing. So, yeah, I mean, that'd just be my guess, but I could remember some tag teams in some smaller territories called the Terrorist and that kind of thing. So not so far away from that.
Okay. All right. And here is another quote from him, astonishingly enough, from July of 1968. And the quote goes, "Richard Nixon has never been one of my favorite people anyway. For years, I've regarded his existence as a monument to all the rancid genes and broken chromosomes that corrupt the possibilities of the American dream. He was a foul caricature of himself, a man with no soul, no inner convictions, with the integrity of a hyena and the style of a poison toad. The Nixon I remembered was absolutely humorless. I couldn't imagine him laughing at anything, except maybe a paraplegic who wanted to vote Democrat but couldn't quite reach the lever on the voting machine." My question is, what if Hunter S. Thompson had met Gordon Solie? Would he have been strictly at the opposite end of this Richard Nixon quote? Would he have liked Gordon Solie? That's what I'm asking.
Well, you know, the first thing I would say is that's a pretty famous quote from that time in political writing. Yeah, I mean that's the hyena thing, like, definitely stuck around. I'm not sure that I would think that maybe they did meet. Gordon Solie liked to live life a little skewed and liked his cocktails and altering his consciousness and certainly Dr. Thompson liked to do the same thing, and alcohol was one of the ways he did it. And like I said, there's a you go look in The Shark Hunt, which is an anthology of Dr. Thompson's work, pretty early on there's a passage or two where he writes about, and some of it was fictionalized, you know, but he writes about having created PR pieces for the Florida Wrestling Office. And so if he really did that, he would have met Gordon Solie. If he was just inspired by wrestling in Florida at that time, he would have watched Jordan solely on television. So I would suspect, it's just suspicion that the great Gordon Solie and the great Hunter S. Thompson may have shared a cocktail or two at some point.
Okay. I would hope that this was true. I'll try to do some research and get back to you on this. Okay.
All right. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I'm definitely a Hunter Thompson guy, and I'm definitely a Gordon Solie guy, so no problem there. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, Bruce, I have seen some wrestling polls that in some people's opinion, they say the best character gimmick belonged to the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, while others say it was Jimmy Wang Yang, and I myself go for the Hurricane. What, in your opinion, who was the best character gimmick? Who had that?
Wow, that's a lot of across the spectrum. I mean, there were characters in professional wrestling in the 1920s and 30s and, you know, Whisker Savage and all that. To me, the best gimmick and the best gimmick performer I've seen in 40 some years and also going by money is The Undertaker. The Undertaker, you know, it lasted longer. It was main evented at a higher level and, you know, really well performed and all that. Million Dollar Man was a hell of a gimmick based on the life of Vincent Mann, and Ted DiBiase, you know, played it to the hilt, and also McMahon promoted it to the hilt and had him live the life outside the ring. Hurricane Helms is a local guy, and Shane Helms is, and I have a lot of respect for what he took. That what he took was a gimmick to kind of make fun of, you know, his comic book fandom and his stuttering and his, you know, speech impediment, and he made it work, and to this day he does a great job with it. I have a lot of respect for Shane Helms. So but yeah, there's a lot. I mean, again, I judge by money. So if you're looking at money, it's Undertaker.
Okay. All right. Well, at this time, I'm going to turn it back over to Sign Guy, and thank you for your comments on Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas by Hunter S. Thompson.
Great book. Yeah, great book. Anytime.
Back to you, Sign Guy.
Thank you, QT. Well, Bruce, we got a few minutes left of the show, and I want to give that time to you. If there's anything you'd like to say to the listeners, plug and promote anything you want, social medias, merchandise, the newsletter, your favorite laundromat, anything you want, floor is all yours.
Well, they won't let me in my favorite laundromat. At PW Torch, wait a minute, let me do this. Twitter, I screw this up all the time. Follow me on Twitter at Mitchell PW Torch. I'm pretty active there. And also PWTorch.com and then PWTorch.com/GoVIP, where you can find the information to go over the paywall with us. And I do three Bruce Mitchell audio shows usually a week, and then do a lot of different podcasts, and we do roundtables after big pay-per-views. And so tonight's Money in the Bank. So Wade Keller, Todd Martin, and I will do a roundtable right after it, going through all the minutia of the major show tonight, and there's a lot to follow. So appreciate everybody who's looked at the free site, and definitely appreciate the people who have subscribed to VIP. Like $9.99 a month, and you get the benefits of a library that goes back 30 some years that you can go through. And I've been podcasting for 15 years now. So as I said, longest running weekly wrestling podcast of them all. So anyway, that plenty to plug.
Well, Bruce, I want to thank you very, very much for being with us today. We greatly appreciate you taking time out of Mother's Day here to speak with us. Look forward to reading and listening to what you have to think about not only the Money in the Bank tonight, but on all the things professional wrestling, just like we've done for many years, and continued success to you and the PW Torch.
Thank you. It's kind of cool to be back on Blog Talk Radio. It's been a while. So, yeah, very interesting. And can't go wrong with Henry Rollins and Dr. Thompson. So I enjoyed it. Definitely.
All right, fans, definitely, if you have not, check out the PW Torch. Read some articles by Bruce Mitchell. I think you'll enjoy it. It's a great newsletter. JB, do you have anything you need to plug, perhaps some merchandise?
Always got merchandise. You can always find me at jbmoonshine, .vb27 at Gmail for my email. And I'm always on the YouTube if you need to relax and see some good hillbilly drunken matches. You can always find me at jbmoonshine. Facebook, same way. And hopefully we'll be having live events soon.
That would
That's
be nice.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, we'll be back at it. We just got to be a little more patient. Fans, you can join us next week. Next Friday afternoon, we will have Pacific Northwest Wrestlers Squatch with us. And a week from today, we'll be back. Another Northwest wrestler, Chris Brady, will be with us next week. So definitely take time to be with us then. We'll talk to you soon. Everybody stay safe out there. And happy Mother's Day to all the mothers listening today.
WWE sucks!